Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You're listening to NBC Sports Philadelphia.
The guests you want to hear from. The Phillies information you need. It's At the Yard.
Hello and welcome to At the Yard. I'm Corey Seidman alongside former Philly Ricky Botalico, and this is going to be a September-themed Phillies podcast with the season wrapping up, these final three series against the Braves, Rockies, and Braves, all must-win games for the Phils. As a reminder, we're presented by Deborah Heart and Lung Center. If it's your heart, demand Deborah. Visit demanddeborah.org. So, Ricky, I was thinking about this with Vince Velasquez and Nick Pivetta both pitching in the Braves series. Neither of them has gone especially deep into starts lately. And we have seen in 2018 something that has never been done before in really the history of baseball, which is teams using the opener. The Tampa Bay Rays made it fashionable. And now they're over the last month, teams across baseball have been doing it on a sporadic basis, a game here, a game there. What's your take on the opener? And do you think that Gabe Kapler, being a new age type manager with a new age type front office, do you think the Phillies could employ this in the future?
It wouldn't surprise me. I think the Phillies could have actually thrown this in this year. And I'm not talking at the beginning of the year. Look, you look at the guys you had in the starting rotation. You're not going to do it to Nola. You're not going to do it to Arrieta. But then the next three guys, we've seen ups and downs, inconsistency. So wouldn't you want to take an inning away from them and maybe kind of mix in a reliever at the beginning, especially going towards August? Because if you watch these guys in August, it looks like they've gotten a little tired. It may have helped them a lot when you think about it. I mean, If you could have gone out there and shortened the game for some of your starters that you needed to shorten the game for, these guys haven't pitched as long as they have in this season in the past. But, I mean, I think if you would have done that, yeah, I think it could have helped out the Phillies. And I'm not a huge fan of it. From being on the field, the hardest inning is the ninth inning. There's no doubt about it. So you wouldn't want to waste your best reliever in that situation. But I think if you have a guy that can go multiple days in a row and you feel comfortable with him, especially at the beginning of a game, give it a try.
So just to explain for those of you who might not know, the opener is teams using a reliever or in some occasions even a starter who can't go as deep, a starter coming off the disabled list, to pitch the first innings, sometimes the first two innings based on matchups, and then kind of going at it from there. And the reason I bring it up is because Vince Velasquez, his last seven starts, he's pitched 25 innings. He's averaged fewer than four innings per start his last seven times out.
There's product of circumstance, too.
Yes, it has to do with how Velasquez has pitched, but it also has to do with Gabe Kapler having so many relievers at his disposal in September. There's a dozen guys in the bullpen available on any given night. Yeah, so you know that's why it could make sense. And I do agree that the young Philly starting pitchers this year, Pivetta, Velasquez, Eflin, they all kind of hit a lull around August. Mm-hmm. And it makes sense. They were all approaching their innings limits. What I look at it is where it would benefit the Phillies. A game like the Braves. The Braves, their best two hitters. You know, Ronald Acuña has been great this year, but their most established, productive, long-term hitters, Freddie Freeman, Nick Markakis, lefties. That is an occasion where you could use a right-handed reliever to begin the game, pitch to the first two hitters, bring in Luis Avilan to pitch to Freddie Freeman and Nick Markakis, and then go from there. That way you have the lefty-lefty matchup in the first inning, you avoid the platoon advantage for the Braves, and then perhaps you go to another pitcher who can give you four innings thereafter.
Right, and I think it wouldn't hurt in the situation where you look at a guy like Sir Anthony Dominguez. Not a bad guy that's a guy I would throw out in the beginning of the game. Reason why I'm saying that is, look, he's had a lot of pressure on him at the beginning of the season. You go into those situations, that's not pressure anymore. But you know he's a quality arm, and you know he's got quality stuff to throw into that situation. And and quite frankly, you take a load off of his shoulders. So, yeah, I mean, you're making me think about it more, which kind of gets me going a little bit. And then I think about it, well, you know, it would probably help out a guy like him.
Yeah, and so Sir Anthony Dominguez, especially when you're facing a top of the order that's right-handed heavy, that guys who have righty platoon splits that are better against lefties than they are against righties. And yeah, to your point about the pressure, if Sir Anthony Dominguez allows a home run in one of these games as an opener, it's not even remembered by the end of the game, whereas if he gives up a home run to Ryan Zimmerman in the ninth inning in walk-off fashion, yeah, that sticks out a little bit.
Well, if you notice, Gabe hasn't really been throwing him towards the ninth inning right now. I think they're trying to take that load off of his shoulders and just let him pitch, let him go out there and relax and pitch, and it's kind of helped him out a little bit. I just think, you know, as long as you could erase outs, I think it's a positive. Now, the one thing that I mean, you bring this up, and the thing that, like, pops into my mind, how are they going to pay relievers in the future? What is, I mean, you go to arbitration, what is your argument anymore? Unless you're a bread closer, what is your argument?
That's a great point, because in arbitration, the things that count towards money, games finished, innings pitched, the counting stats like that, they don't take saves into account, they take games finished into account.
Right.
Well, obviously, if you're opening, you're not finishing. And I think of, on Tampa Bay, Ryan Stanek, who's been their opener most of the season, guy who has great stuff, been really good, but he's not going to have any of those traditional reliever stats at the end of the season. So, yeah, when it comes time for him to get paid, they're going to have to start looking at these things a little differently.
Well, the reason why I say that is because when I first was pitching, I led the league in holds my first year. You couldn't use that in arbitration.
Wow.
They didn't count. There was just – I mean, there was such thing, but there was no such thing. And it was a weird situation because I'm going in there, well, what do I go in with?
Mm-hmm.
That I had a good ERA? No. You just try to figure something out that's going to go in your direction. But, I mean, to me, what are the stats these guys are going in with nowadays?
Yeah, and the other thing is if the opener becomes more commonplace around baseball, I wonder if they're going to change the qualifications needed to earn a win in a specific game. Because if you look at it, it's always been you need to go five innings.
Right.
However, if the starting pitcher doesn't go five innings, the win goes to whoever is deemed the most effective pitcher that comes in after that. So pretty much you're saying, okay, you can go two innings if it's the fourth and the fifth and get a win, but you can't go two innings if it's the first and the second and get a win.
What makes you an official scorer? Do you know that answer?
I don't.
Isn't that a strange question?
Next time I'm over at
that, this could be Joe Schmo off the street saying, all right, this is the guy that should get the win in this game. There should be a formula of some sort. Because I believe that a starter can go three quality innings, and then the bullpen does the same all the way through, and those guys are only going one or two innings.
Right.
Then, you know, the starter should get the win. But, see, there's a bigger problem in this, because now you're changing history at this point.
Exactly.
I don't know how open – Major League Baseball is open to everything, but changing statistics is a whole different world.
Well, I'll say that, like, as a 29-year-old guy who's been watching baseball his whole life, these last couple years feel like the most dramatic shift in the game I've ever experienced, just in terms of the way everybody's utilized. So, yeah, the win has always been that way. That's the way history is. But, I mean, the game's changing so much that might have to be changed as well. So, moving on to related to this, we talked about how there's a dozen relievers in the bullpen. Mm-hmm. It's why Gabe Kapler's been pulling his pitchers early. The month of September, 40-man rosters. I can't ever remember in my lifetime seeing the Phillies actually get to 40 players.
I don't know if there's ever been a team. I haven't looked this up yet, but I really do have to look this up because, you know, as far as about 5 years back, it used to be you have to earn that. You have to make your way there. But when you look at the Phillies roster this year, everybody was up and down.
Exactly.
So it was like, all right, we have 40 guys on the roster. We're using them all. It used to be a protection thing where you had to protect certain minor leaguers. Now it's just like, let's get everybody on the roster we can and see if we can't use that.
So one of the aspects of that is something that's kind of been under the radar this season. For years, for decades, the knock on the Phillies was that they waited too long to bring young players up. We've seen this season, they haven't waited. I mean, they brought Scott Kingery up from day one. They felt comfortable enough with Sir Anthony Dominguez to bring him up early in the season. They're not holding guys down anymore when they think they're ready to contribute because there's a lot of young players making an impact across baseball. So, yeah, to that point, one of the reasons that they are at a full 40 is because all 40 guys on that roster are players who they deem to be major league ready in some form. So my question is, should this rule about allowing every team to have 40 guys in the clubhouse, in the dugout? Should it continue? Because when I looked at it, at the point that the Phillies got to 39 before Aaron Loop was activated, no other team in baseball had more than 36 guys active. So the Phillies had three more right. than any team in baseball.
It's a little much. 40 guys, fine. You want to suit 40 guys, that's fine. The way I think Major League Baseball should handle this is that you get 25 or 26 guys either in a series or that night. So I really believe that I guess the only way to do this is maybe give you two extra bench players. You have to keep your starters on there or else that has to – because you can't – if you're switching up the starters, you're going to end up with 10, 11 relievers anyways.
Your starters isn't your starting pitchers?
Yes, starting pitchers.
Interesting. Because I would think that if you had to designate 25 guys, that the easy thing for teams to be, okay, well, the four non-starting pitchers, the
right.
guy who's not – they're not –
But that's why I said in a series, maybe that would change things
a
little bit.
In a series, right.
But I think you should be able to suit up 26 guys in a game. Everybody stays on the roster. I don't think that would be even an issue. But let's say you have a reliever that just pitched 3 days in a row and you're not going to use him. You could take him off and, you know, go from there. But I just think too many guys, too long of games, and it just drags on.
Yeah,
is that really what baseball's looking for?
I mean, it's easy to see the logic in it. It's strategic. And, yes, you want to bring in a lefty to pitch to Freddie Freeman. You want to be able to do that in a game, and then you want to be able to bring in a righty to pitch to the next batter if he's a right-handed hitter. So I get that, but it kind of waters down the product. Guys are in there for half the game, and I look at Wednesday night, and I don't disagree with this decision, but Odubel Herrera hit a smash, a two-run homer. His next at-bat, he was pinch-hit for in the fifth inning for Jose Bautista, and it worked out. Bautista contributed.
Right.
The same way it worked out the night before when Gabe Kapler used Wilson Ramos and Justin Bourdais pinch-hit for Crawford and Kingery, and it worked out. But the thing is,
telling your players?
You look at the box score at the end of the night, and nobody's in the position they started the game in. It's just
right.
It's
it
crazy
is kind of odd
at.
In that sense. I mean, the worst one I saw was the Kingery thing. What was that, about a week ago?
In the second inning?
Kingery gets pulled in the second inning. Why even bother? If you knew they were probably going to switch up pitchers, why are you even bothering?
Well, I think in that case, they just figured that the left-handed starter was going to pitch into the second inning, so they wanted to get Kingery one at bat there. I asked Gabe Kapler about this on Wednesday. I said, is that a tough conversation to have with Odubel after he just hits a homer, especially for a guy who has been kind of struggling for the last couple months, and he comes off a good moment.
Way to go, kid.
And then you pinch hit for him. And his answer, I mean, his rationale was, that it's optimizing the matchup, but it's also protecting Odubel from matchups that he might not fare well in.
Well, let me put it this way. Very simply, you look back on the first 3 months of the season, that would never have happened.
No.
You look at it now because he's been struggling for most of the last 2.5 months. Yeah, that's going to happen. But Gabe will tell us that it's all about confidence in your players. I understand that. But when you're doing that, that's not showing confidence in your players. That's showing the complete opposite, if you ask me.
One of the things Gabe also said about Odubel was that going into Wednesday's game against Noah Syndergaard, I looked at the numbers going into that game. He was 1-for-18 lifetime against Syndergaard.
Right.
So when I saw that Herrera was in the lineup, I'm thinking, what's going on here? If you're playing matchups, this doesn't make any sense. And Gabe said that when he went back and looked through all of those 18 at-bats, Odubel had competitive plate appearances. He was aggressive against him. He looked good. And, you know, I'm going to have to ask Gabe next time he comes back to town when the Phillies get back in, do you do that every single time that you look at the matchup? Because if you're there's all this video that they have at their disposal, but I doubt that anybody has enough time to go through every career at bat for every hitter against every
pitcher.
Well,
they have enough people working on it.
True.
I'm sure somebody probably does go through it. And when you ever ask Gabe about who's in the starting lineup, what does he say? We. Here's what we put together. It's never just him. And that's fine. But I just think if you're a starter in the big leagues, you're a starter in the big leagues, and you should get opportunities at the big league level. I feel like at some point, Gabe and the rest of the organization is kind of dictating what these guys could actually do and limiting their chances. I just think baseball, obviously, if you fail 7 out of 10 times, you're pretty good on the hitting aspect. But you know, when you're not given those opportunities, what happens when you only have 25 guys and you're put back in that same opportunity, and in the back of your head, you're like, well, they used to pinch hit for me in this situation. Now I'm in this same situation. For a player, I think it's just confusing.
Sure. So, okay, along those lines, Gabe Kapler's first season, there's been some good, there's been some bad. The Phillies are 5 games over .500 heading into the Braves series. albeit with a -7 run differential. And by the way, I've gotten a lot of questions about this season. Would the Phillies be the first team ever to make the playoffs with a minus run differential? They would not. In fact, the Major League record for the worst run differential by a team to make the playoffs, the 2005 Padres, who made it at minus 42. So the Phillies.
Why doesn't that surprise me that you said the Padres?
Yeah. So the Phillies at -7, that's a far cry from minus 42. But, I mean, when I look at the run differential, I see -7, yet a team that's five games over 500. In my opinion, for much of this season, Gabe Kapler did get a whole lot out of this roster. Some of that was because pitchers were emerging in the first half and making things, you know, easier, but the Phillies were also winning a lot of one-run games, which spoke to good decisions in the latter innings, among other things, also success from relievers. I'm curious for what you have found this season to be the most impressive aspect of Gabe Kapler's rookie year and the thing that you have disliked the most.
Staying the course, I think, would be a positive for him. I don't think he let anybody knock him off course. I think he has taken a straight line, and he was sticking to his guns. I mean, isn't that what you want in a manager? Look, we have nothing here to blame Gabe Kapler on. He was hired to do exactly what he's doing, be a positive influence on the players, stay confident in these players, and keep their thoughts in a positive notion, right? Isn't that what he's brought in for?
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, I don't think he's brought in to teach these guys how to swing the bat, or, you know, to do this or that. I think that's what analytics does to them. But, I mean, that being said, he has stayed the course. He hasn't let anybody push him off of that course one way or the other, besides the first week of the season when apparently the relievers went in and had a talk to him. And I think that was probably needed. So, I mean, to me, he's a guy that came in and said what he was going to do. He's steered the team in the right direction. And quite frankly, offensively, I do not think the team's been good at all.
No, they haven't. I mean, in a lot of ways, the Phillies have been similar to the 2017 Phillies, who lost 96 games. The numbers aren't all that different.
No, the numbers are right on target for runs scored, if I'm not wrong.
And their numbers are also very similar to the New York Mets, who have a whole lot less talent than the Phillies have. For me, the biggest positive for Gabe that I've seen this year is that this is not an easy town. We all know that. It's not an easy town to be a first-year coach in any sport, and until you win, you don't really get that respect. People, when Charlie Manuel first got here, criticized him, and then as soon as he won, he was looked at as a genius. Doug Peterson, when he got here, people talked about him like he was a bumbling oaf the first year, and then he won a Super Bowl, and now he's very well respected.
Sure.
So what I like about Gabe is that this season, it's like he's ignored all the outside criticism and just done his thing. He's done what he believes in, and whether that is right on a given night, he's doing what the front office hired him to do, and he's doing what he believes in, and he's not letting the old school mentality in this town dictate how he manages on a daily basis. And I respect that. I got to respect anybody who sticks to their guns that much.
That's the biggest part of him being a manager is that he's not letting anybody tell him what to do. It's ears closed, and I'll say what I want to say. And I think that comes out in his press conferences, because he comes right out, and it's always the positive first, because he's trying to dictate the press conferences, if you ask me.
And I would think that I wouldn't say this is my negative, but one of the negatives, one of the things that I think that we will see change over the course of his managerial stay here, is that we're not always going to hear the most glowing praise every time a guy has a good game. Like, when a guy has a good game, it's the best he's ever looked, and you know,
so true.
Yeah, and not that there's anything wrong with that, because he's trying to build up his players and give them confidence, but there are some times where it just doesn't match up with what we're seeing on the field.
Right.
And I think that's when Gabe starts to get questioned by reporters, and I think that's when fans start to, like, respond in a frustrated way as well.
Yeah, I think it's glaring in filling up the seats at Citizens Bank Park. And the reason why I say that is these fans want to hear the truth. They don't want to hear that they lost 10-1 and Alfaro had a good at-bat in the third inning. They don't care. They don't care that Alfaro had a good at-bat in the third. What they care about is the final score.
Mm-hmm.
And when Gabe comes on and does the whole positive thing, that's when this town erupts. They don't like that. And that's one thing I think that will always be a negative on Gabe in the fans' eyes, is that he doesn't want to come out and bury anybody.
Right, and there is value to that, because, we don't know what's going on behind closed doors at all times.
Sure.
There could be times where Gabe is having stern conversations with his players that we just never hear about, and it makes sense to not put that in the public sphere. But what I compare it to is when Andy Reid was here, when the Eagles would play a sloppy game, he would come out and he would say, I didn't put my players in the best position to succeed. That was the typical Andy Reid line that by the time he was in year eight, we were all just like, okay, enough already. Enough. We got to do a better job. Yeah, time's yours. But, you know, the Phillies have been such a bad defensive team this season. There have been so many sloppy games by the Phillies, and there haven't been enough times where anybody has said, we just need to be more prepared. Or like, oh, we need to – maybe it's not a matter of preparation. Maybe it's just the talent level or the defensive skill. But I think that's where fans got frustrated this season, is that what they were seeing was not matching to what was being told to them.
The laser focus.
Right.
That may be the worst line that he probably could have used all year, because he's still using it. And when you look at him and look at the team and look at fundamentally the team, those two things don't go together. That you're telling me that these guys, when they step up those steps, are laser focused, laser sharp focused. No.
Some, not all.
Well,
I mean,
yeah, but you need every guy that's playing.
Well, okay,
to be
let me ask you this.
Sharply in tune.
Over the course of an 162 game season, I know it's different for you having been in the bullpen. You know, you're not in the dugout the whole game, but among the relievers, were there ever nights where you saw that guys were just kind of disinterested or going through the motions or not really all the way mentally there?
Usually when guys were coming off of injuries, when they're not all mentally there. And the other thing is, back in the day, you were afraid for your job. Now it's – nobody's afraid of losing their job now.
What do you mean
by that? I don't see guys out in the bullpen if they're going to – come on. They have guys that will have 4.5, 5 ERAs, but they're still fine. They wouldn't have a job 5 years ago. They'd be back in AAA or released. I mean, you really have to do a number on yourself to get – kicked off of a team nowadays. I mean, you look at Hector Neris. They did the right thing in that situation.
Yes. Uh-huh.
He was struggling mentally. You send him down, and then when he's better, you bring him back up, which is what happened to him. But you don't see them do that to everybody.
Right.
How long did it take them to figure out the Neris thing that he wasn't getting better?
It's a great point, because it took until he had a 6.90 ERA until
well,
he allowed three homers.
Really,
and
a miserable, miserable game.
After he had already had several meltdowns, and then he allowed, what, 6 runs in the one inning with 3 homers against the Nationals, and that was when it was finally time. But I'm glad you brought him up, because Hector Neris has been – a second-half success story for the Phillies, when it's been pretty dismal in many other ways. Hector Neris has the second-highest strikeout rate in all of the National League, behind only Josh Hader, 14.3 strikeouts per nine. He has 70 Ks in 44 innings.
29 in his last 16 appearances.
Yeah, and he's averaging, since he came back, he's averaging 2 strikeouts per inning, which is just mind-boggling, and it makes me wonder, did Hector Neris do enough to solidify himself as a late-inning reliever next season?
Probably. I mean, look, the main thing is everybody loses it a little bit, whether it be in your mind or fundamentally. And I think he went with both, because I'm seeing a completely different guy at the big league level now. I'm seeing a guy who has a lot more trust in his split. Look, think about this. Before he got sent down, he wasn't throwing a split that was going below the belt. And that, to me, was not only an example of just him not having good control of the split, has a lot to do with his fastball. He stopped throwing fastballs.
Yeah,
I can remember 4, 5, 6 splits in a row.
He was at like 60 to 65% splits, which is not sustainable
but you
without
can't
blowing
pitch.
Your arm out.
Number one, you can't pitch like that. That's the other thing. I'd still be worried that at some point that's going to get on his elbow at some point.
Yeah, I mean, it's happened to Masahiro Tanaka. When he came to America, he was throwing split after split, and he's been having UCL issues the last couple of years. If it's not UCL, it's something elbow-related.
But answer to your question, I think he definitely solidified a role late in the game. I don't know about a closer role, but he's definitely solidified a late-inning role.
And the last thing I want to just ask about Neris is, there's talk whenever a guy has a good second half in any sport, can he carry it over in the next season? Did you ever at any point in your career feel like you had such a good first half, or such a good second half, or such a bad second half, that by the time next season rolled around, you were still feeling what you had felt?
No,
that
you
previous...
lose that.
Yeah, I mean,
you lose that confidence level. You lose everything until you get back to spring training and then get back in a regular game, because you're a completely different person. Whether you like it or not, things change over the off season, because you're not going off the mound every day. And by the time you come back, you're in different shape. You're stronger at points. There was a year I came into spring training, and all I did was work out, and then started throwing later on. And when I came back, I was throwing 97, 98 miles an hour, but I didn't know where it was going, because I had a nasty sink on the ball because my muscles were different. So literally the first 2 weeks of spring training, I had to I had to throw long toss, long stay off the mound and long toss, long talk, just to get my muscles stretched out again. It happens. Stuff like that happens. You think you're doing the right thing in the offseason. You come back, you're a completely different pitcher sometimes.
Yeah, so just everybody out there listening, keep that in mind when you see any great performance from a Philly in the month of September, that it doesn't always carry over what you're
seeing.
They
always say you can't make the team in September.
Right, and especially because you're facing, a lot of the time, you're facing
minors.
Guys who don't belong in the majors.
Right.
But again, on the flip side of that, J.P. Crawford the other day, 3-run extra base hit against Zach Wheeler. He's not a slouch, so it's not like J.P. Crawford in that situation was doing his damage off a mediocre September pitcher. Coming up on At the Yard, we're going to talk about the non-Philly who stood out most to us this season. I'm not necessarily talking about, you know, J.D. Martinez, guys of that ilk, but either a guy who really took his game to another level this season or who burst onto the scene in 2018. And that's next after this health tip from Deborah Heart and Lung Center.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This is At the Yard, the podcast.
We're back here on At the Yard. He's Ricky Botalico. I'm Corey Seibin. And now we're going to get to... We're going to go around the league here. The non-Philly who this season impressed us the most, who stood out the most, a guy who just could qualify for most improved player or for rookie of the year. We can go either way with it. So I'll start with you, Ricky. Is there someone who sticks out to you?
I'm going to go a little different level. A guy that I think has gone from good to great. I'm going to say Christian Yelich. You take a good look at what this guy has done. Not only defensively is he very, very good, and he's a plus player defensively, but offensively, right around 320, 315 to 320 hitter, plus 30 home runs, plus 30 doubles, 20 stolen bases. I mean, you put all those things together, you turn into a great player. I think I'm just a little bitter that the Phillies didn't have the opportunity to get that guy, because I think he would have been perfect in this lineup. But, I mean, to me, he was always a good player. He was a solid player. He'd hit a home run every once in a while. But now... it's almost like he could put a team on his back and run with it for a couple weeks. And I think anybody who could do that is a special player. He's turned into a special player.
I'm with you all the way on Yelich. I think that he's the NL MVP this season. Two cycles. He's only the fifth player ever, I think, to do that. And both of them have come in the second half.
He's gotten stronger.
He's been the best player in baseball in the second half. He leads the NL in batting average, slugging, OPS. As you mentioned, 30-30. Driven in 93 runs despite batting at the top of the order, career highs in runs scored. He has 13 more homers this year than he did last year.
Is that unbelievable?
Well, it's not unbelievable when you consider the park he was coming from. He went from this cavernous Miami Marlins park where there's nobody there, there's no adrenaline provided to you, to Miller Park, which is one of the most hitter-friendly venues, great batter's eye. So I guess it shouldn't be so surprising that he took things to this level, but it's just kind of cruel for Phillies fans to have to deal with, because it's like the one-off season that they finally spent money after years of losing. They brought in Santana and Arrieta after years of trying to get Yelich in a trade. They were unable to. Another National League contender did at the end of January, and the Brewers really didn't give up much to get Christian Yelich.
Which is a bummer.
Which is just the most frustrating thing, because you look at what they gave up. They gave up Lewis Brinson, who was their equivalent of, like, Nick Williams. When the Phillies acquired Nick Williams from the Rangers in the Cole Hamels trade, they picked between Lewis Brinson and Nick Williams, and the Phillies picked Nick Williams. Brinson ended up going to the Brewers. I'm pretty sure it was in the Jonathan Lucroy trade, and then he went from Milwaukee to Miami for Yelich. So you're right. Nick Williams would have been more of a get for the Marlins than Christian Yelich.
And it just doesn't make sense.
It boggles the mind.
It's almost like you're in our division. We're not giving them to you.
The Brewers, in the span of 2 days in late January, added two top five MVP candidates, Lorenzo Cain and Christian Yelich. So when Phillies fans talk about how frustrated they were by the offseason, that's what they're looking at. Look at that duo in comparison to what the Phillies paid for and have received this season.
Think about where they might be right now.
Yeah.
The Phillies would be right now.
Absolutely.
If you had Christian Yelich on this team. Completely different look to your lineup.
So I'm with you on Yelich. I'm going to give a guy who is a rookie, who's not going to win Rookie of the Year because Acuna and Juan Soto have just been so good. But Jack Flaherty on the Cardinals, a right-hander. He's 22 years old, about to turn 23. 26 starts this season, ERA barely over 3, 30 more strikeouts than innings pitched. What I like so much about him, though, is that he just has this old-school mentality on the mound. He's a right-hander who goes inside. He hammers guys inside. He throws his sinker inside to righties. He throws pitches you don't ordinarily see in a righty-righty matchup. And it's because he just has that gusto. He has that confidence to do it, and you don't see that. I mean, there's a reason that he leads the National League with 10 hit-by-pitches. Well, it's because he doesn't fear coming inside,
right.
And there's not a whole lot of pitchers that are like that these days.
But that's a good thing. I mean, I wish some of the Phillies pitchers would be like that. They got some guys that throw hard on the Phillies. I mean, you look at Vince. Vince throws hard. You look at Pivetta. He throws hard. Eflin can throw hard. These guys really don't go in and try to throw strikes inside. If they do, maybe a little bit for effect every once in a while, and that's usually with a sinker that gets away. But, I mean, I watch the game now, and I'm like, how do these guys even pitch if they're not showing inside? And it's kind of refreshing to know that a younger guy is actually doing that.
See, I think that's something that could take Zach Eflin to the next level.
No
doubt.
If he
starts throwing more consistently inside with his sinker. Because
well, he likes to throw that sinker on the outside part of the plate to righties.
But if you can start making them think about the sinker down and in, the 95-mile-per-hour fastball, forcing fastball up and away, then also have to worry about a changeup and the slider, the fact that the slider is moving the opposite way from the sinker, I think that could really take Zach Eflin to the next level, because when I look at those three guys at the back end of the Phillies rotation, I think he has the most tools in his toolkit.
Oh, he definitely could throw it. The one thing that I see, though, and this is the problem I've had with Pivetta and Eflin in the second half of the season, until lately. Eflin's been throwing the ball well lately. But I think they fell in love with that up-top fastball.
Yep.
I really do. It was almost like, I want to get the two strikes so I could elevate the fastball. Well, what they don't realize is that at the beginning of the year, when your arm's live and everything, you got that little extra jump and your location's better, and then all of a sudden your arm deadens out a little bit, that pitch does not become effective
That's
anymore.
So true, because if it's 96.5 miles per hour up in the zone, maybe it's by a guy. But if it's 94.8, it's not the same thing.
94 without any jump to it, yeah, you're in some trouble. And I think especially Pivetta has run into that. And I think you look at a guy like Pivetta, and he hasn't been able to sneak anything up top lately by anybody.
Yeah.
That's a problem.
So just sticking with that old school theme, the other guy I would point out this year that really has stood out to me, a guy that the Phillies thankfully will not have to deal with next week at Coors Field. He was originally scheduled to pitch Monday. Instead, he's going to go Sunday in Arizona, and that's Kyle Freeland, who you might remember his name because he was taken one pick after Aaron Nola, the year that the Phillies drafted Aaron Nola. Freeland's been unbelievable this season. He's pitched at Coors Field unlike anybody has ever been able to pitch at Coors Field in terms of keeping the ball in the yard. His ERA is almost two full runs lower at Coors than it is away from it. Sub-3 ERA, 31 starts. He's allowed 3 runs or fewer 27 times. So that's a guy to me.
That's impressive.
And when I say old school, I mean because he relies on his cutter. He doesn't care about his strikeouts. He cares about spotting the ball. And baseball's obsessed with strikeouts these days because strikeouts for batters and pitchers are at a sky-high rate.
I don't know if you can be obsessed at Coors Field with strikeouts. And I know it sounds horrible, but I think in Coors Field, you're looking for soft contact is really what you're looking for. Because once you get solid contact, there's a good chance that's off the wall, in a gap, or over the fence. So, you have to be careful at that ballpark.
So the Phillies are going to Coors Field next week. That's going to be a humongous series. I mean, if the Phillies are able to win 3 out of 4 against the Braves.
I don't like it.
Well, I don't like it because the Rockies are a desperate team. They just got swept by the Dodgers. So now they're falling out of the NL West race. They're also falling out of the wild card race. They entered Thursday night a game and a half behind the Cardinals for the second spot. The pitching matchups in that series, everybody except Nola will pitch.
Yeah, that's
kind of dangerous.
Not fun.
I'm just
especially
curious.
For sinker ball guys, because you don't get that type of sink. The one thing that I did learn about Coors Field, and Tony La Russa was adamant on this, make sure you use your changeups. Because early on there, people wouldn't use their changeups because they thought it was just a dead pitch. It would stay up in the zone. No, it's probably the most effective pitch out there because you have to keep people off balance. If you go in there just trying to pound your sinker and you don't get the good movement that you would get elsewhere, because look, if you haven't played there, you don't know. The ball does not move. I mean, your curveball, you have to slow it up. You have to make sure you get better rotation on it and pull down on it. If you don't, it's a spinner. It's gone. Well, kiss it. That's
all
there is.
That changeup is going to be crucial for every Phillies pitcher that goes in Colorado because Charlie Blackmon at the top of that lineup, a left-handed hitter with power, he's as hot as he's been all season long. He hit this bomb off Clayton Kershaw the other night at Dodger Stadium in a lefty-on-lefty matchup. And it just got me thinking that, wow, the Phillies are going to have to deal with two of the hottest hitters in the National League in Freddie Freeman and Charlie Blackmon here in these final 11 games. So all these righties better have their changeup working.
Yeah, you better be ready to play. And I'm telling you right now, I mean, you have a bunch of games against the Braves. You better come with your A game. You don't come with your A game against this team, they could bury you in one inning.
Yeah, the Phillies are confident. I mean, they're confident going into Atlanta. However, it's been nearly four months since these teams met. The Braves are they're a lot different team. I mean, this was before Ronald Acuña took off.
They're better than they were.
Ronald Acuña, in the 4 months since the Phillies last saw the Braves, has an OPS over 1,000 and is at 21 of his, I believe, 27 home runs. So most of that damage has come since those 12 early season meetings.
First inning extremely important for Phillies pitchers.
Yeah.
That first inning, because the Braves will jump all over you. You leave one pitch over the middle of the plate to Acuña, you might as well put a run up for the Braves. You don't want that.
Yeah, and at the same time, there are outs to be had at the bottom of that lineup. Yeah. I mean, Ozzie Albies has tailed off. And if you remember back to the beginning of the season, the guys that were contributing the most for the Braves against the Phillies were no-name players. Ryan Flaherty?
Ryan Flaherty.
Remember Ryan Flaherty? Babe Ruth, huh?
Yeah.
And Ryan Flaherty was doing all that damage. Kurt Suzuki was really hurting the Phillies earlier in the season. So I think that's another key, is that you have to take care of the bottom of that lineup because you know that Freeman and Marquegas are always going to give you competitive long at-bats.
Pick your poison.
Yeah.
That's what this whole series is going to be about the rest of the year. Pick your poison.
All right, that does it for At the Yard. I'm Corey Seibin. He's Ricky Vitalico. We'll talk to you again in about a week.
Thanks for listening to At the Yard on NBC Sports Philadelphia. Be sure to subscribe to At the Yard wherever you listen to podcasts.